The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Start the clock.
You, the one with that smile, yeah, come over here for a while. Hey, girl, do you hear what I say? I don't have time to be waiting all day.
My name is Travis B.
My name is Chris Lambert.
Welcome to Film Colossus.
Your guide to movies?
Our energies were really combating there. Like, I was going real slow and dramatic, and you were like, I got to get this out.
It was my first time doing this half of the intro.
Yeah.
I was just like, what do... And the second time that we've done it in general, so it's just like...
I got to ask, how do you think it's going so far? I feel like that had a lot of power.
I think once we, like, stick the landing on it, once we're just, like, Olympic-level duets, it is going to be just, like, powerful. It's going to be something that gives people, like, raises the hair on their arms.
I completely agree with you. Today, we've already wasted 45 seconds of our time, so we got to get moving. We have 40 minutes to talk about the movies we watched this week, which, as I say that out loud, sounds like an absurd amount of time. Like, that's plenty of time. But for us, I feel like we're going to be going right down to the wire.
Yeah, every time. It's just going to be something where somehow we manage to, I mean, right now is a perfect example.
Absolutely. And people keep an eye on your clocks, because if we ever do go over on time, we're going to start adding that time up and receive some sort of punishment once we've gone, what did we say? 30 minutes over time?
30 minutes over time.
All right. God, I feel like we're already close to that. So here we are. We're going to talk about every movie we watch over the past 2 weeks since our last episode. We're going to list all the movies. We're going to talk about our favorite movie, each of our least favorite movies. And then at the end of the episode, we're going to reveal what movie we'll be covering next week on the show.
That's right. Your list is longer than mine. Do you want to start or should my shorter list kick things off?
I'll jump in. So since you and I last talked, we talked in January 4th, but the episode released on January 5th. So I guess it's everything we've watched since we last talked. Mm-hmm. I have watched 14 movies in 14 days. I consider that right on par with where I want to be.
Beautiful.
And the 14 movies I watched were, in order chronologically, were The Big Combo, an old film noir, Resident Evil Afterlife, the fourth Resident Evil movie where Paul W.S. Anderson comes back to the show, Terrifier 2, I can't wait to talk about that one, Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again. I had watched the first one recently, so we just get to the second one. Bend It Like Beckham, never seen it before, my wife loves it. Pale Blue Eye, Snore, Megan, we talked about that on the show already. The Menu, John Wick, we wanted to watch the John Wick movies because the new one's coming out soon. The Front Page, an old slapstick comedy kind of thing. It was like the original His Girl Friday. Nobody knows any of the words I'm saying. Notting Hill, a romantic comedy starring Julia Roberts and Hugh Grant. Friday the 13th, which I had never seen before. Crazy.
The OG.
Yeah. Drive My Car, which I'd always been interested in watching. And Aaron Brockovich, Soderbergh.
What a range, like an absurd range of movies. What was the oldest of those that you watched?
The oldest one would be The Front Page, which is like 1931-ish.
And what was the newest?
The newest, I guess, would have been Terrifier 2.
Yeah, man. You're going classics, rom-coms.
Let's see. And of those, there were only 4 rewatches, so 10 new movies.
Whew. I'm curious what you thought about Bend It Like Beckham.
Yeah, I really enjoyed. I mean, this is an open forum, this part of the show. You can ask about any specific one you want, Chris. I can give some short answers.
Yeah. Because I feel like that's not going to be one of the ones you directly expound on.
No. Like, that wouldn't be, like, the best movie I watched this week or the worst movie I watched this week. It's, like, right in the middle. Yeah, I really enjoyed it. It's, like, it kind of has that... Do you ever watch Disney Channel original movies?
No.
You didn't watch, like, Brink and, like, Alley Cat Strike and stuff?
No, the only one I think I ever saw was Dig, but that was like a theatrical or Holes.
Holes doesn't count. That's not a Disney Channel original movie.
It's not even a Disney Channel movie?
I don't think it is, actually. Okay. Although Shia LaBeouf was in a Disney Channel original movie called True Confessions.
But that doesn't sound like it should.
Okay. Anyway, yeah, I really enjoyed it, though. It's a movie I've always known my wife loved and watched a lot as a teenager, and we've always talked about it. We even play do you know that game Framed? It's like Wordle for movies.
Oh, yeah.
Where it shows you a frame of a movie. And I showed my wife the first frame, like, do you know what this movie this is? And she instantly knew it was Bend It Like Beckham, even though it was just like a nondescript picture of like nothing. So I'd always been interested to watch it, and it was a fun time. It's always fun to watch like that kind of movie of somebody who really loves it. Like, I feel like it becomes infectious and makes it more enjoyable.
I remember watching it years ago. I think I had just had ACL surgery, and I was just looking for kind of feel good, positive movies. And it was one of the ones on Netflix at the time, I want to say. Mm-hmm. And I remember finding it very charming and liking it a lot. I always conflate that and She's the Man, because they just both involve soccer.
She's the Man is not... you know what? She's the Man is enjoyable. Channing Tatum's in that one, and Amanda Bynes hadn't gone completely loco yet, so like it's enjoyable.
Yeah, I liked She's the Man a lot. So I always like those movies are always kind of connected in my mind.
Yeah. Were there any others on that list you want my thoughts on? Or
Notting Hill, was that a first time watch or a rewatch?
It was. Have you seen that?
No. I just have the movie poster like burned into my mind for some reason.
I had never seen it, and I had a little trouble getting into it at first. I was like, what is this? It feels stale at first. Like, it feels airless. And I don't know. That is generally just the aesthetic of it. I think it's like, it steeps. And I eventually realized like it's a very melancholic movie. So it's very purposely done that way. And it took me a bit to get into it. But once I settled into it, it was truly a unique movie. Like, especially for a rom-com that came out in like 99, 2000. Like, all those movies feel the same. This one felt very different and honest, and again very melancholic, which I like when movies are sad and shit.
That kind of the guy from Scrubs.
Zach Braff.
Yeah, what's the Zach Braff
Garden
movie?
State?
Garden State.
Yeah.
I remember everybody like going wild for that movie, and it took me a long time to finally watch it. Like, I don't think I watched it for the first time until like 2010, 2011. And just being like, oh, I didn't realize this was going to be such a sad movie.
Yeah.
Or like a melancholic movie.
Yeah. Hmm. I'll have to watch that one again someday. I remember watching it because like everyone loved it and not being super impressed by it at the time. But I would say my tastes have changed quite a bit in 17 years. So.
Yeah. I would imagine just a little bit. But a good rom-com sounds good. I tried watching some of the Tom Hanks rom-coms, like 90s ones, a couple years ago, and I was so blown away by how much I didn't like Sleepless in Seattle.
Yeah, I don't remember really enjoying that one either.
But You've Got Mail, he's still kind of an asshole, but
You've Got Mail's tough because I would rather just watch The Shop Around the Corner, which is what it's based on.
There's a movie called The Shop Around the Corner?
It's a old Christmas movie of Jimmy Stewart.
That's of course. Of course it is. That's just makes so much sense.
But a slight little tangent really quick. I'm reading this book called, I was talking to Chris about it earlier, but I can't remember the name of it anymore. I think Bad Things Are Good for You or something like that.
Yes.
Yeah. Along those lines. But it's talking about, it wasn't in that book. It was a separate article I read. My bad. You should go check out the book though. And it was comparing The Shop Around the Corner to You've Got Mail, and showing how editing has changed so much in movies. And there's a scene in The Shop Around the Corner where Jimmy Stewart's like standing outside of this restaurant and is going to go in and talk to this woman. And in the original movie, there's like 15 cuts. And then in You've Got Mail, there's like 160 cuts. I just thought that was crazy. That was like, oh yeah. Like, sometimes I remember why I like settling into the energy of an old movie a little bit more.
Yeah. Everything Bad Is Good For You.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
Is the name of the book. But yeah, that's a... I don't want to say it as kind of this like ultimatum that...
You're giving Hollywood an ultimatum.
Not even like... Maybe it's not even an ultimatum, but less cuts are better. But typically, I think that the less cuts there are in a scene, mm-hmm. the more trust it shows from the filmmaker.
I know this about you.
You what?
I know this about you. Like, you feel this way.
Yeah. The less cuts, the more trust it shows the filmmaker has in, like, the actors, the choreography, the more impressive it is to me in terms of the blocking and the actual scene playing out, because I know that they had to do it all in that shot. And that can just be a conversation in a restaurant, right? Or just a breakup scene in an apartment and the camera is just like on them talking on the couch. There's something very powerful about the immersiveness of that. Which is one of the things we've watched a couple Lav Diaz movies where he'll go like 6 minutes without cutting.
Yeah.
And it's kind of amazing when you realize he's Filipino.
Yeah.
And it's just like, these aren't, a lot of the actors and people he's working with aren't people that grew up going to acting in school, like going to college for acting, like having these low-grade careers in acting that build up over time until they're like taking extra classes with teachers and getting like the best that Hollywood has to offer. He's working with people that don't have that same background, and it blows my mind the performances he gets out of them and the performances they give in these movies and these scenes where they can't hide via like the cuts and the editing. It's like, obviously, in You've Got Mail, like Tom Hanks and who is it?
Meg Ryan.
Of course.
The same two people in Sleepless in Seattle.
Yeah. It's not to say that they're like, of course, they're like wonderful, like highly skilled actors. But it's just, I don't think the movie does them justice by having that many cuts.
Yeah. Mm. Do you know the other Meg Ryan, Tom Hanks movie?
I'll have what she's having.
That's right. All right. Now, Joe versus the Volcano, which I've never seen.
Oh, I always meant to watch that because I like volcanoes, but...
Yeah, that's right.
I'm not like a big Tom Hanks person, so...
Well, can you handle the volcanic activity of their love?
I don't know if I'm ready for it.
All right, that's enough about what I watched. What'd you watch, Chris?
Okay. I watched White Noise.
Oh, yeah.
The Noah Baumbach Netflix movie based on Don DeLillo. I want to say of all the people with a podcast, I'm probably in like the top five Don DeLillo fans.
Well, you're a top five Don DeLillo fan, period. So yeah, probably if people have podcasts as well.
Yeah, probably. Though I feel like everybody that has like an NPR podcast is probably fuming at that. So they're just like, how dare you?
You should go to battle with them.
And then I watched Megan, which, you know, we talked about,
of course,
on our previous episode. The Pale Blue Eye, I also watched. Puss in Boots, The Last Wish.
Oh, yeah.
And then Knives Out was a rewatch. So of those, there was one rewatch, which was Knives Out.
The original Knives Out.
The original, the OG, the 20.
And you like that movie, right?
I like that movie.
I mean, everyone likes that movie. I say that like I'm accusing you of something. Everybody likes Knives Out.
Yeah, you're the one.
Yeah, I'm the only one who does.
You're the weird one here. Don't it's gaslight true. Me.
It's true. Yeah, I feel like I want to ask about The Pale Blue Eye, but I also feel like you might be talking about that movie soon.
Yes.
Okay. And I would ask you about Terrifier 2, but like I'll be talking about it soon.
Oh, so. Terrifier 2. I forgot to name that. Terrifier 2 too.
Oh yeah. Okay. Are there any in that bunch you want to expound upon at all before we move on?
Yeah, I guess it would be White Noise.
White Noise. Okay, yeah. I guess that's the one. I mean, you're a Don DeLillo fan.
Yeah, I was excited. So there's one other adaptation of a Don DeLillo novel that's Cosmopolis, mm-hmm. that came out in 2011, I believe, starring Robert Pattinson. It was one of like Pattinson's, maybe it's 2012, his first post, what are they called again? I want to call it Breaking Twilight because of Breaking Dawn. Yeah, Twilight movies. And I think he's marvelous in it. And I think it was a good sign of where he was going to go post Twilight. But it's a very weird movie. It's very stylized. It's Cronenberg, but it's like low budget Cronenberg.
Yeah.
And a lot of the movie takes place in a limo, and some of the aesthetic choices or like visual effects are kind of like weird, but there's this amazing final scene that's Robert Pattinson and Paul Giamatti just going at it for 20 minutes via dialogue and really getting to like showcase their acting. It's one of my favorite like climactic stretches in a movie. But it's a very weird movie because of Don DeLillo's writing style. The dialogue is very staccato, very stilted, very unreal. You can tell that it's a little hard for the actors to get into the flow of the conversation, which has been kind of a criticism of DeLillo and his novels like from the get-go. But
yeah,
White Noise, it was very similar, which was striking because like Cronenberg and Baumbach are very different filmmakers, and it's a very different story. It's a like small town life, which a little heightened, like it's getting into mortality and a fear of death and how this affects this couple. But the dialogue in the movie is still very staccato, very stilted. It sounds like the exact characters from Cosmopolis, which was kind of funny. But as like visually interesting as the movie could be, it was just like so supremely boring to me.
Oh, wow.
That it kind of fell like very, very flat, which I didn't expect because I was pretty excited for it. It's like the performances are fine, like good concepts. And I don't know if it's just maybe like, if I were to read the book, I'd maybe feel like the story in the book was a little like eh as well.
Yeah.
But the movie just didn't do much for me at all.
Interesting. I feel like Noah Baumbach can fall into that trap. Like he has movies that have deeply affected me, like The Squid and the Whale and Marriage Story. But I almost feel like those movies worked so well because they hit close to home on stuff I'd experienced, which is something I think he's really good at. Like capturing this very like domestic setting and just like all of the fears and joys of, you know, being with your family and stuff. But I do think he can settle into boringness rather easily. Like I don't remember liking Francis Ha that much. I'm trying to think of what other Baumbach movies I've seen, but that doesn't surprise me, I guess.
Yeah, it was the first time I've ever seen Greta Gerwig in anything.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because I never watched Frances Ha, and she was like kind of the best part of the movie to me.
She's great, yeah.
Yeah.
I will say, Chris, there are two other Don DeLillo movies.
What?
Don DeLillo wrote a script for a movie called Game Six, stars Michael Keaton. I've never heard of this movie.
No.
And then a movie called Never Ever came out in 2016, is based on the novel The Body Artist.
Wait, what? It's one of my favorite novels.
Well, you should watch this movie.
Never Ever, 2016?
It's like a French movie.
That would be why. I was following like the details of Cosmopolis, which was made in, like it was funded by somebody in Portugal, or there was all this drama around it too. Okay, Never Ever. Yeah, 2016 mystery romance directed by Benoit Jacquot, starring Mathieu Amalric and Julia Roy. Roy also wrote the screenplay for the film based on The Body Artist. Amazing. Well, thank you, Travis.
We'll probably hear you talk about it in the next episode.
Yeah, I need to figure out how I can possibly watch this.
It can't be hard. These days, you can watch anything.
I'm going to have to be...
within seconds.
Yeah, Never Ever Just Watch...
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an Orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Okay, so we've talked about our movie diaries for the last 2 weeks. Now we're going to talk about our favorite movies that we watched. And then...
Yeah.
And then after that, we'll talk about our least favorite. Favorite. Should I go first?
Yeah, I know what your favorite is, I think.
Yeah, you
do. Know what mine is.
I do. You're right. So my favorite was... this is going to be rare on the show because I think I'm pretty stingy when it comes to handing out 5-star ratings for movies. The last time I did it, every time I start one of these sentences, I know I'm just going to like lose people. But the last time I gave a movie 5 stars was Flash Gordon, which a lot of people think is like a terrible movie, but like I absolutely love it. So that would have been 2 years ago. And I think before that, the last time I gave 5 stars was to Magic Mike XXL, which came out in 2016.
Wow.
So they're pretty spaced out. So Terrifier 2 is a 5-star movie for me. Like when I first started watching it, I was like, all right, I think I'm gonna like this. Like, I know it's super gory, which I like, and people seem to be turned off by it, which is usually a good sign to me. But I didn't expect it. Like, I didn't know if it would be great, basically. And so I started watching it, and it started settling into a rhythm. I was like, all right, like this is awesome. Like, I'm giggling at all the murder scenes because they're so ridiculous and over the top. And it just, as the movie kept going, I kind of had that like that creeping feeling of like, is this doing like what I think it's doing? Like, is it transcending above like everything I watch? And like more and more, it became apparent to me that it was doing that. And I would say once I've reached the final like 40 minutes, because it's like a 2 hour, it's like a 2.5 hour movie. Once I had reached like kind of like the final scene of the movie, like the big final act, like I knew that it was one of those movies and I was just like all in. So yeah, Terrifier 2 was, I'm going to sound like one of those film critics you see on TV when they do the pull quotes. It was a triumph in horror, an unequivocal triumph in horror. It's just doing everything I want movies to do. It's both like stylistic, which is most important to me, that it like is very bold in the way it is, and it's forceful with its aesthetic. It's very indulgent, unabashed in the way it carries itself, in the way Art the Clown is killing people, but more importantly, I guess, how all of that style relates to the central story at hand, which is Sienna and her brother. Oh god, I'm forgetting her brother's name. Is it Daniel?
No,
Chris, look it up.
Yeah.
I know you will.
I'm looking it up right now.
Jonathan. Yeah. Just how basically the story starts with Jonathan and Sienna are living at home with their mom, and their father had recently committed suicide, and you're kind of watching them not directly deal with it, but like going about their lives, but you can see how it has affected them. And the movie makes it very clear quickly that like Art the Clown has become this representation of not just grief, but like trauma, of not understanding why this happened to you and having this sort of hole in your life that you can't fill because your dad's not there anymore. You can't possibly answer why this kind of thing happened. But their whole journey with Art the Clown becomes a symbolism of trying to not figure it out, because you can't figure it out, but managing it in your life and learning to live with this hole that will forever be there. And so every kill, every time Arthur Clown kills somebody, it is a representation of like how people in your life are affected by your grief and your trauma as you kind of try to move through life and try to be normal, but you're not. And so there's such urgency and there's such drama to all of the killings that it isn't just like fun kills that are fun to watch. Like, they're directly related to what these characters are going through. And it's this visualization of their trauma. And the worse and worse their trauma gets, the heavier and heavier the kills become. And I think the thing I love most about it is, this is my nerdy reach here, but he's called Art the Clown. And he is literally a representation of art. He represents what art means, how these fantastic creatures can come to represent something, these ultra ridiculous, like over the top characters can just represent normal, very real things in all of our lives, and shows how we all deal with these things and how we come to terms with these things and how we learn to live with these things. So he is literally a representation of art, and everything he does is just like, it's an ode to the power of art and how powerful it can be.
There's something I could imagine people being like, well, just because the name's art, but in the film, the dad was an artist, and he has an entire like art book that Jonathan is kind of keeping to himself and hiding from the family. And it has these very dramatic, like really well done drawings. And it ends up foreshadowing, like in the notebook, you see Sienna eventually become this like this figure that's in the notebook, and you see Art the Clown in multiple drawings. So like art is literally art in the movie.
Yeah. Yeah. And the dad had seen the clown, I guess. He's drawing pictures of the clown. So it isn't just that, like, you don't have to stretch anymore to say that he's a representation of something. Like, this clown actually haunted the dad. He is literally the symbol that is the link to, like, what drove this dad so crazy that he took his own life. And that's why Sienna and Jonathan are, like, so consumed by it and trying to understand it and trying to destroy this monster.
Yeah. And the fact that their dad's an artist, like, Sienna is, like, designing. Like, she's creating art. And it's actually the costume that she makes that she uses to like battle, like in battle against art. So there's a lot of symbolism, whether like intentional or not, like it's there.
Yeah. Oh, so absolutely love that movie. Sorry I talk so long about it, but I feel like I gotta talk about the ones that matter.
No, absolutely. I think it's something like I think it's something that if I were to talk about it, I'd just say like, oh, it was kind of slow for me.
Yeah, right.
It didn't hit me in the same way that it did you, but I can, like, I completely understand where, like, why it's appealing to you and where that's coming from. Like, I ended up putting into my rankings, I think, in like the positives section, because there were some like good things. It just wasn't quite my like pacing or aesthetic, but I did appreciate a lot of what it had going on.
Yeah, I will admit that, like, I kind of like when people don't like the movies I really like.
Yeah, absolutely. That's like, your thing.
Yeah, that makes me love it even more.
And the thing that I think the initial, like, arts funhouse or the clown cafe, whatever it was, that was the first scene where I was just like, ah.
I loved every second of that scene.
It was just like it rang like a little hollow to me. It was so drawn out and long.
It was just like,
okay. But the first like 15 minutes of the movie, I thought was like pretty brilliant.
Yeah, the 80s feel.
It's just like the 80s feel, like the introduction to art and some of the like the character introduction and vibe and everything. Like it was feeling like very good.
Yeah. Great movie.
My top one, also I ended up giving 5 stars.
Oh, baby.
Puss in Boots, Last Wish.
I'm excited about this one.
Yeah, I had no idea, because I'm not like a big Shrek fan. Like, I enjoyed Shrek. I liked Shrek 2. Like, Shrek 3 I thought was better than what some other people maybe thought. But I've never been like a huge Shrek person. I don't make like inside Shrek jokes. I don't like meme about Shrek on the internet.
Do you have friends that do that?
I know movie people that will like, they get excited about like Shrek references and Shrek humor. Sure, I'm sure. Just like, yeah. I never watched like any of the spinoffs. I didn't watch the first Puss in Boots. I had no plan whatsoever to watch this one. In fact, Discussing Film on Twitter like posted something in December that was like, Puss in Boots is one of the highest rated films or getting some of the best reviews of like all of 2022. And I quote tweeted it with just doubt. And it was like very snarky about like the quality of Puss in Boots. And then I went to go see it because people voted on it as being the movie that I should go watch next. And blown away, just completely, like, absolutely start to finish, blown away. It has, like, some of the Spider-Verse feel to it,
right,
in terms of, like, that next wave, next level of animation. And it's not rotoscopic in a way, but just the way in which it's utilizing the camera feels very fresh and very much something that only animation can do. Rather than being as like having the same fidelity to the standard like filmmaking methods. So there's like a lot of great visual like aspects to Puss in Boots. But the story is what like the story and aesthetic really like landed for me, because I had in 2020, I had a existential crisis for the first time. I was listening to Kid A at like 3 a.m. just because I usually listen to an album or audiobook before falling asleep. And in the middle of that album, which is a very like kind of sad album.
Oh, yeah.
Like it's heavy. It's haunting. Like people talk about it as like Kid A, one of the most haunting albums of all time kind of thing. And in the middle of listening to it, I felt like what it meant to die. Like, yeah. It was like a switch went off in my head. And I was like, oh, this is what it means to like no longer exist, where you lose like all sense of perception, all memory, all thought, all feeling, all future, all potential. There was just this like sudden emptiness I felt in my chest that was horrifying. Like I couldn't fall asleep. I cried. Like it was like really sad. It's causing me to tear up now, even like thinking back on it. And it kind of haunted me for like a year and a half, where I was like trying to distract myself before going to bed. It was a very like long battle to kind of like work through that, cope with that, like figure out some feelings on it, which included even going back to therapy. So it's like a dramatic thing. And to see a movie that's like supposed to be a kid's movie get into Puss, like the titular character, having a existential midlife crisis relating to death and what it means to die and fearing for his life, leading to panic attacks and like loss of esteem and loss of identity, and the way in which they portray death through this character of the wolf. It's amazing. It's like,
yeah,
I don't know of another movie that's handled this kind of story in such a way that's like dynamic, emotional, interesting, fun, but like timeless. Like, did it feel like a kid's movie to me? But it had like some of that energy, of course, but it was funny. It was smart. Like every scene just felt dynamic and didn't overstay its welcome. Like it kept moving. And that's something that I really appreciate. Like I can know that like plot points are coming.
Okay.
Like the opening song of this movie is Puss singing, whatchamacallit, like I'm a fearless like legend or something. It's like, okay, he's going to lose his fearlessness, but it's just so dynamic going through it that I was just so pleased. And John Mulaney is amazing in it.
So. Is he the, what is he again?
He plays this character, Jack Horner, who I guess is from some fairy tale where he like puts his thumbs in pies. And he's just like a little pie
boy. He's a little like sidekick.
No, he's the villain.
Oh, he's the villain. Oh, okay.
Yeah, he goes from like this little like roly-poly boy that likes to eat pies to being this like big badass dude who wants to just like hurt others.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like a lot of what you're describing is what Pixar aimed to do early on. Maybe wasn't always super successful at, but dealing with these very heavy subjects in a light way, in an effortless way. And allowing, like, still being a fun cartoon, like, still going through all these motions that makes a movie entertaining while hitting on something deeper and more profound.
Yeah, definitely.
All right.
But Pixar.
I will say that I remember the first time I saw the Puss in Boots trailer, I was kind of like, oh, is this? Because as much as I remember enjoying the Pixar movies, like, I've seen bits and pieces of Pixar movies I used to love here and there. Like, they definitely don't hit the same as they used to. And I can't say, like, I really care for animation at all. Like, it's just not a genre I get that excited about. Like, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse is one of the few, like, I have loved in recent years. But Puss in Boots, when I saw the trailer, I was kind of like, all right, it was making me laugh a lot. I was like, I would watch this.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And I haven't been a fan of recent Pixar movies all that much, or even like, I know Disney has been like having a lot of hits, but I also feel like Disney has maybe gotten like a little bit formulaic. And DreamWorks has had some movies that I really liked in the past in the animation departments. How to Train Your Dragon was like the first one was pretty impressive to me, and the first Kung Fu Panda. But I feel like Turbo was pretty good too. Rise of the Guardians was also pretty good. Man, they've had some good ones. But like the recent string of DreamWorks movies, Penguins of Madagascar, Home, Trolls, The Boss Baby. Maybe Boss Baby's better than I imagine, but it wasn't appealing. Like The Croods, A New Age.
No.
So with them making Puss in Boots: The Last Wish, I was just like, well, you know, DreamWorks isn't Pixar. It's not Disney. Is this going to be that good? And it was.
Yeah. All right. I'm going to do it eventually.
Yep.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
All right. Now, time for my favorite part of the show where we talk about the worst movie we watched this week.
Yeah. Do we have the same one?
I feel like I should have the same one as you for the sake of saving time, but technically I hated one more than the one you're going to do.
Oh, what's yours?
I feel bad because like this is a movie I know people really like. And this, I guess, is just the same old story for me. It always is. I always don't like the movie everyone seems to like so much. I really, really... It's funny because after I first watched it, I was like, I didn't really enjoy that. But, like, there was some good stuff about it. And as I've thought about it more and more, like, I really hate it. And that is The Menu.
Oh, wow.
There's a kind of movie I just like have a very visceral negative reaction to where it's like, I don't mind satire, like satire, making fun of stupidity, like that's fine. But like sometimes when it's done with a certain kind of energy, it feels gross to me and overtly cynical in a way that like doesn't vibe with like the way I am and the way I look at the world. And The Menu to me was kind of that. Like, I understand everything it's doing. I understand it's a commentary on class, a commentary on, like, art and passion and how society can change the way your art and passion is viewed. Like, there's all this stuff there that's profound and, like, interesting to talk about. but every avenue it goes down to talk about it to me feels gross, feels just super negative, not very honest, very cynical. Just, I hated all the characters. Like, I don't mind if a movie has characters that are bad people. Like, that's a recipe for, like, talking about social issues in a way that I think could work. But all of these people are just presented in awful ways, and there's nothing interesting about them other than just how terrible they are. Everything about the movie just felt off to me, and that I was supposed to just be, like, laughing along and, like, laughing at these stupid rich people, like, steep in misery. And I just, like, I never enjoy that kind of movie. So this movie both felt ugly and empty to me, and so it's down at the bottom.
Yeah, that, as I had my initial, like, surprise, and then as soon as I was like, oh, I was like, oh, yeah. Because for everything you said, there is, like, an innate cruelness to it, which I've learned very recently is something that just has no appeal to you, which is funny that then, like, Terrifier 2.
Yeah, I know, right?
But there's, like, a degree of redemption in Terrifier 2, I guess.
Right.
Or, like, it's so over the top that it's hard to just, like, the negativity feels almost like wink, wink.
Totally. I think there's nothing but joy in Terrifier 2. Like, even when people are being killed, like, I get what it's doing. I get the more profound statement it's trying to make.
Yeah, where it's like you already get the statement and then everything's just kind of cruel and, like, the payoff and... There's no real, like, interconnect. There's no, like, with Terrifier 2, you have Sienna and Jonathan and, like, them as brother and sister, like, dealing with this and, like, working through their issues. And you don't really have that bond or that positive, like, hopefulness in the midst of the menu. Like, you have, what's her name? Margot? Or.
Yeah, Margot.
Yeah, the main, character
Anya Taylor-Joy,
yeah, kind of having, like, a little bit of a dynamic with the chef, but
a forced dynamic.
Yeah
I don't know, that whole movie too, like, part of the reason I really hated it was I thought it was doing something for a long time and I kept giving it chances, like, as it was going, I'm like, all right, this is, like, well paced. Like, there's some interesting ideas here. I like that they're showing, like, the menu items. Like, it was having fun. I was into its energy. But as soon as I locked into, like, kind of the cruelness of it, I had this moment of, like, all right, like, it's going to do something at some point. Like, there's going to be some twist, some reveal. There's going to be, as you said, some sort of redemption. Like, something's going to twist at some point that makes it more than just, like, rich people suck. But it never does. And the whole thing between Margot and the chef, like, I honestly don't understand, like, what they're even trying to say with that. Like, maybe you know, Chris, because you wrote the movie guide, but, like, yeah. I wasn't extracting anything, like, very deep that where I had this moment of, like, oh, like, it's clicking. Like, I was trying real hard and nothing was hitting to me.
I mean, you might be curious if reading it, the movie, in a way of that it's a commentary on art or on Hollywood, and with the chef as, like, a filmmaker that's been, like, sucked into the system, and, like, the menu that he's making being more of, like, the kind of procedural movies that are made versus, like, just making the cheeseburger kind of movie.
Is that what you wrote? Is that what you think it's doing?
It's an aspect to what's going on. There's definitely, like, I think a criticism of the entertainment industry in there.
Interesting. Yeah, that is kind of a part of the movie. I will say, if that's what the movie's doing, it makes me like it even less. I can't stand when movies are just, like, super loose allegories for something. Like, maybe there's some connectivity there between that and Hollywood, but, like, I'm just supposed to watch this movie about a chef, but also just know that the chef is representation of this other thing. I don't know. I hate when movies do that.
How's that different than, like, Art the Clown representing, like, grief in The Grief?
Because those sayings are, like, I guess grief is so intricate. It's such a part of that movie. Like, I guess Hollywood, like...
Yeah.
Like, it kind of reminds me of when you talk about like killing them softly or something, like representing the financial crisis. Like, I would just kind of look at that and I'm like, how is that the best approach to this? Like, can't we become more intimately entwined with the subject?
Yeah. So if the more like disconnected the narrative of the film is from what it's commenting on, the less that works for you.
So if
you
want actually like, commenting on that thing, yes.
Yeah, you want a little bit more of like a direct overlap there.
To me, that's just like, that's like the most elementary, lamest way to cover a subject. Like, there's nothing, I don't know how to get emotionally tied to something like that.
Okay, I can see that. I mean, like, Killing Them Softly being about the financial crisis, but it has like, it's a gangster movie that's yeah. like so far removed from like Wall Street and like any of the impact versus something like The Big Short, which is very much in
right
the situation that it's talking about.
Interestingly enough, The Big Short, directed by Adam McKay, who produced The Menu. That's the other thing I was going to say, is that like there's lately these old like titans of comedy, like Adam McKay and Will Ferrell and Vince Vaughn. Like, they've been producing these movies that basically just talk about how stupid everything is. And I wish I could get on board with it, but I've really not enjoyed it. Like Chris with the Campbells, Vince Vaughn produced that. And like, I get no it's supposed to be a joke about Hallmark movies, but I'm like, while I'm watching that movie, I'm like, this is, I'd rather watch a Hallmark movie than this. Like, it's so just like cruel and just mean in a really boring way. That's my like review of all these movies.
Damn. Okay.
All right, what do you got? I know I don't like the movie you're going to talk about.
Yeah, I got The Pale Blue Eye.
Yeah.
It wasn't offensive to me. It's not right. like it's in a bad category or I'm as upset with it as you were with The Menu. It was more of just kind of a neutral to not that great kind of vibe for me. Like, there is something cool, and I did realize that I kind of missed a little bit of the historical picture that's not just like straight up history but just set in a time like that. I feel like we got a lot more of those in the 90s and 2000s than maybe at least what I've been watching recently. Mm-hmm. Like, it's been a minute since I've seen like this kind of costuming, this kind of like setting with like the winter of upstate New York or wherever it's set.
Right.
So I liked the tone of the movie and some of the like the vibe of it. It's just, it completely took me out of it that Edgar Allan Poe was a character. Like, I can't get over it. I had no idea because I didn't know anything about it going in. So I just started watching it and suddenly it's like they're talking about poets and suddenly Edgar Allan Poe is just right there. I was like, wait, Poe? Like, that's Poe. Is he going to do like Edgar Allan Poe things the whole time? And sure enough, he's just like poetry whiz, like investigative, like mastermind. Like,
yeah.
It almost felt to me like, are they starting to like lay the groundwork for an Edgar Allan Poe like movie universe where it's just going to be like,
I hope so.
This character going forward, maybe that would make me like the movie more. Like Christian Bale was just kind of like a get you into the theaters, like to watch the movie since it's not in yeah. theaters. And then he passes the torch on to what's the kid's name?
Oh, the Dudley Dursley.
Yeah. Dudley Dursley. And that's like where the series goes and like the franchise goes from there, is like Edgar Allan Poe getting caught up in these like crazy events that then inspire all of the like poems and stories. I just found it like a tad bit cheesy, and I did like the mystery elements of it, especially in like comparison to Glass Onion, where I was like, sure. Oh my God, like, okay, thank you for just like an actual mystery. But it was still like a felt like maybe a little thin, like not that climactic. And then rewatching Knives Out, I was kind of like, yeah, like I'm enjoying what Knives Out is doing, like more than this. So yeah. It's like Pale Blue Eye. I could see it being a movie that surprises a lot of people. They watch it and they're like, oh, you know what? That wasn't bad. I like that. But it just didn't do much for me.
Yeah, I think in my rankings, I have it in the just plain bad category, where like it's not like awful, you know, it's worse than mediocre, but it's not like offensive like The Menu. It's just like this feels like an incompetent movie a little bit, like in the sense that it's just so boring, and it's so boring when it's so packed with interesting ideas about life and death, about like Satan and the occult.
Revenge.
Yeah. Just spirituality in general. Like there's all this stuff there, but it's just a little too lame, a little too drawn out, a little bit too like dolting. Is that the right word? When you dolt around?
Yeah.
It's just everything about it is, it's just a sludgy movie. That's how I describe it. Sludge.
Yeah. And then by the climax, I was like, this is it.
It was kind of surprising.
I was like, so they're all like doing this together, but he doesn't know. And he's willingly participating in. Okay. Just yeah. Okay.
I do love the idea, though, that there's like this probably already exists, actually. But like just history nerds love shit like this, like. The idea of like it's almost like fan fiction for Poe, you know, like what if Poe like was a detective, and like they're trying to make Poe sexier, and really it's just like so lame.
I mean, did you ever see 2012's The Raven?
I did not.
It's Luke Evans as a detective in Baltimore.
That's right.
And they end up like. Tapping into, they enlist Poe to help in catching, like, so there's a murder mystery, and it's like, oh, this is inspired by Edgar Allan Poe's story. Let's go to Edgar Allan Poe and ask him how to catch the guy. And it's just so bad.
Yeah.
So it's like, I had that in the back of my mind, which maybe you would like it.
Who knows?
It's John Cusack playing, like, Edgar Allan Poe and being, right. Like, so over the top. It's like an elegant Poe that's like very confident and like, I'm Edgar Allan Poe.
God, I hope he says that in the movie.
I'm Edgar Allan Poe. I just found it like, I don't like when they have Edgar Allan Poe as a character enacting like Edgar Allan Poe things. I think that's kind of the worst way to go about it. So... I thought it was better than The Raven, but it still made me want like a style of Edgar Allan Poe movie that's not like bastardizing Edgar Allan Poe's stories.
I think you need to write this movie, Chris.
Fine, fuck it, I'll do it myself.
Okay, let's go ahead and stop the clock there. We're at the 10 minutes and 55 seconds over.
Yep.
All right, I think that might put us over the edge. We may have to figure out what we're going to do as punishment sooner rather than later.
I have an idea of what it should be.
Okay. I like that we're not going to say what it is. You'll just know when you see the episode title.
Yeah. I'll be like, this is it. This is what these fools have been hyping up.
I will say, as much as I crapped on The Pale Blue Eye, I did write a movie guide for it if you want to go learn about all the deep wonders of that movie. That's the one thing I like about doing these movie guides is like writing about a movie I don't like. It's like a weird form of catharsis for me where like I kind of come to terms with it and I'm able to look at it a little objectively and realize what it's doing. And by doing that, it kind of helps me hone my own likes and dislikes. Like, okay, I can see that a movie's doing this, but here are the reasons I like all these other movies that are doing the same things way better. You know, it helps me like kind of understand what I do and don't like in a movie.
It was similar to me doing the Glass Onion movie guide.
Yeah.
Like I went from writing like Glass Onion, bad writing, to then talking about like the themes and the motifs and like, yeah, it's saying some things and doing some things. And I appreciate like those elements and it is cool how it like develops those things. Okay.
Ugh. I don't know if I could have written The Menu though. I couldn't do it.
One day.
It's impossible.
One day.
Anyway, okay, we're at the end, right?
Yeah, this is it.
What do we want to tell people to do?
This is the end.
We have a Patreon. If you would like to join our Patreon. We don't have many benefits right now other than, like, you don't have to listen to ads. So if you want to support the show and not listen to ads, head over to patreon.com/filmcolossus and sign up.
Yeah. And we'll be eventually adding some more things relating to the podcast, like access to things, the website. So you can also check out the website filmcolossus.com and see all of our in-depth movie guides. They're a lot more objective than opinionated, but also check out our rankings for movie years. So like you can see where we rank things for 2022 specifically, or follow along in our 2023 rankings, or just see our all-time rankings.
Yeah. And if you want to hear what we thought about any of the movies we didn't talk about, they'll be on the rankings eventually. I'm going to try to do all mine today, but we'll both get those up soon.
Yeah, getting those done ahead of the podcast.
Well, I plan to do it today, so that will be ahead of the podcast.
Yeah, yeah. That's a system, Travis. That's a system.
And last but not least, we got to reveal the movie we're going to talk about next week.
Oh, yeah.
Do you want to say it? Do I want to say it?
Yeah. 3, 2, 1.
The Magic Batman. Mike. Oh, wait. Oh, yeah. We're talking about the Batman.
You got to wait another another round of podcast episodes before Magic Mike hits.
Magic Mike, The Last Dance.
Yeah. February 10th, my birthday.
Oh, wow. Whoa, what a birthday.
I know. Shit. I knew you'd be jealous.
Should have come out November 6th.
I know. But The Batman, which I'm a fan of the movie. You're less so. So it'll be interesting to dive into it.
Yeah, I'm interested to watch it again. It wasn't necessarily that I thought it was bad, but it wasn't my cup of tea. But we'll see. Maybe this time it's my cup of tea. Maybe it's Gancha tea.
Gancha? What kind of tea? Gancha?
I think I mixed ganja, which technically you could make tea out of, and some other kind of tea. I just said a word.
Being creative at the end of the episode, I like it.
Yeah. All right. And until next time, I don't know. What do we? What are we gonna do?
I don't know. We'll figure it out.
Figure it out. All right. Bye. Got a big question to ask. Anything? Do you wanna do anything?
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.